sanctions. Foreign companies remain interested in this market as they anticipate its largest potential. But the road to Iran's market has been obstructed by U.S.-imposed sanctions. Based on figures from OPEC, nearly 80% of the world's proven oil reserves belong to member countries. The majority of these reserves are located in West Asia, amounting to some 64% of the OPEC total. Iran has over 156 billion barrels of proven oil reserves as of 2019, which is roughly 9% of the world's share. Going off of OPEC statistics, Iran produced nearly 3,000 barrels of oil per day on June 2021. Production figures would be much higher if it were not for sanctions imposed on Iran by Washington. Iran's oil industry has faced heavy sanctions since former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018. According to the Ministry of Oil, the average daily production of oil before the reimposed sanctions was over 3 million barrels per day. The government has plans to surpass the pre-sanctions production levels to over 4 billion barrels per day. That's, of course, under the stipulation that the sanctions against oil companies and exports are removed. As you might know, Iran's oil industry is a major engine behind the country's economic growth. Oil exports generate millions in foreign revenue, but the country also uses this valuable resource in other industries to make various products. Petroleum and petrochemical products, such as plastics, are also derived from oil and natural gas, and Iran makes a large amount of both. Figures from the Iranian National Plastic and Polymer Industrial Association show that Iran can potentially export $5 billion worth of petchem products. Currently, over 6 million tons of polymer products are domestically produced every year. Another derivative of crude oil is gasoline, and Iran completely supplies its domestic needs with its daily productions. In the past year, due to reduced internal usage, much of the surplus was exported to international markets. Based on the National Iranian Oil Products Distribution Company, last year nearly 700,000 barrels of gasoline fuel were produced each day. Data from this company shows that Iran has managed to boost its gasoline exports despite sanctions. Over $1 billion worth of gasoline was exported in the first half of last year alone. That's higher than the year 2020, when Iran exported nearly $500 million worth of this commodity. All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear friend and colleague out there in the field who has prepared an interesting feature for you. Let's go check it out.
The electric elevator industry in Iran is 80 years old. Initially, packaged elevators were imported into Iran, but currently, dozens of domestic manufacturers are producing different models of elevators and lifts, as well as their equipment. Some of them have managed to export their products to other countries, and today we are visiting one of them. Now, the sector is thriving. Iran has the capacity to produce 80,000 lifts each year, but annual productions are at 25,000 units due to stagnation in the construction industry. The total number of operating elevators in Iran is at nearly 750,000, from which 250 million people use on a daily basis.
We are almost out of time for this program, but before we go, let's briefly check out some news and trends about Iran's non-oil exports. According to the head of Iran Customs Administration, Alireza Muqaddasi, Iran exported 122 million tons of commodities worth $48 billion in the previous year. While the value of annual exports has risen by 41% compared to the previous year, Iran imported more than 40 million tons of goods worth $52 billion, including basic commodities, raw materials, and machinery. The top five exporters to Iran were the UAE, China, Turkey, Germany, and Russia, while the main destinations of Iran's exports included China, Iraq, Turkey, the UAE, and Afghanistan. According to Vice President for Science and Technology, Surena Sattari, in recent years, different steps have been taken with this regard, such as launching houses of innovation in Kenya, China, Russia, Syria, and Turkey so far. The centers are mainly formed with the investment and support of the private sector to provide the necessary infrastructure for the exports. Knowledge-based companies gained about $800 million in revenue from exports in the Iranian calendar year ended in March 2021, and the figure was expected to reach up to $2 billion in the following year. Africa, neighboring countries, Southeast Asia, and Eurasia are the other target priorities. That covers our program on wood plastic composite sector in Iran. Don't forget to give us your feedback. Also, you can email us with your thoughts and topic suggestions. You never know, we may just make a program on your suggestions. I'll see you next time for another edition of Bazaar.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Contrary to the bank's claim of climate leadership, its pledge to reduce emissions intensity is fully compatible with a massive expansion of fossil fuels, said one campaigner. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Bank of America accused of using accounting tricks as real climate action. Here's the story. Climate action groups denounced Bank of America for displaying one of the worst examples of corporate greenwashing as the bank released its climate targets for 2030, centering their plan of action on reducing carbon emissions intensity instead of reducing their absolute emissions. With CEO Brian Moynihan claiming the bank aims to help ensure a just, stable transition to the sustainable future we all want, the bank announced that it would reduce the intensity of its emissions instead of absolute emissions. Emissions intensity refers to the volume of emissions measured against another unit, while a pledge to reduce absolute emissions would require Bank of America to reduce the amount of emissions it is sending into the atmosphere over time. By using carbon intensity metrics, Bank of America has set up a situation where its overall greenhouse gas emissions could continue to rise until 2030, and it would still be able to claim that it has met its climate goals, said Alec Cannon, co-director of the Stop the Money Pipeline Coalition. The bank announced its pledge less than 2 weeks after the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, released its latest report on the climate crisis, reiterating earlier warnings that the continued extraction of fossil fuels, for which Bank of America has provided at least $232 billion in financing since 2016, will put the Paris Climate Agreement's goal of limiting global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius out of reach. In today's announcement, Bank of America touts its history of climate leadership and then unveils 2030 emissions targets, which are intensity only, fully compatible with increases in absolute emissions and massive expansion of fossil fuels, especially expanded extraction of fossil gas, said Jason Opinia Disterhoft, senior climate and energy campaigner for Rainforest Action Network. He added, Bank of America's intensity-only targets, which lag well behind U.S. and global best practice, put it firmly on the side of climate delay when time is quickly running out to cut absolute emissions in half by 2030. Bank of America will face a vote at its shareholder meeting on April 26, with some of its investors calling on the bank to commit to policies ensuring its lending and underwriting do not support fossil fuel projects. Conan expressed hope that the bank's investors will take note of this duplicity and vote in favor of critical climate resolutions. Like too many of its peers, Bank of America is trying to pass off vague pledges and accounting tricks as real climate action, said Sierra Club Fossil Fuel Finance Campaign Manager Ben Cushing, adding, the science is clear that achieving net zero financed emissions by 2050 means stopping funding for the expansion of fossil fuels, he added. Reducing emissions intensity while increasing financing for the fossil fuel industry and overall financed emissions is utterly insufficient to achieve that target and contribute to a climate-stable future.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Scuffles and unrest were reported in several spots across Sweden. Fierce clashes have broken out between police and protesters during demonstrations against a far-right group's intention to burn the Holy Quran. Violent skirmishes erupted between supporters of the Strom Curse party and the opponents of the blasphemous plan. Clashes and demonstrations have been held in a couple of cities. Over a dozen police officers have also been injured since the unrest started. Meanwhile, police has backed the hardline party's plan, saying it would not revoke permission for a demonstration organized by the party, because the free speech threshold for doing that is very high in Sweden. That's why there have been reported clashes in locations that the hardline party either had planned or had demonstrations. Also, Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson came out in support of the far-right group, making remarks that have been deemed provocative. She said in Sweden, people are allowed to express their opinions whether they are in good or bad taste. That is part of our democracy. These remarks only fanned the fire of unrest across the country and drew condemnations from the Muslim world, like from Iran. Iran summoned the Swedish envoy and condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran, saying the blasphemy was committed under the protection of the Swedish police. Tehran said it would hold the Swedish government as accountable and expects an immediate reaction from Stockholm against the perpetrator, as well as practical measures to prevent such incidents. On Thursday, the Hardline Party held a rally in a heavily Muslim-populated area in Sweden. At the demonstration, the party leader burned a copy of the Holy Quran, ignoring objections from onlookers. Counter-protests broke out with demonstrators setting fire to security vehicles after police ignored calls to stop the far-right demonstration. Strom Kurs is well known for its anti-immigrant and anti-Islam stances. Anti-Muslim sentiments have been on the rise across Europe in recent years in the wake of terrorist attacks in the continent, carried out mostly by Daesh sympathizers or the terrorist group's members who returned home following the group's defeat in Iraq and Syria. Muslim leaders in Europe and around the world have repeatedly condemned the terrorist attacks. Moreover, the rise of far-right ideology and the propagation of anti-immigration policies have also exacerbated the status of religious minorities in Europe. Also, different sorts of bans on hijab in countries like Germany and France, as well as closure of mosques and religious centers, have further pressured the Muslim community in those countries. Add to it the discrimination in recruitment and provision of job opportunities, harassment at workplace, and hate speech. Also, hate crimes against Muslims are rife in Europe. While the Muslim communities represent an indispensable minority of more than 25 million people, in the 27 European Union member states, a 2018 poll found that within the bloc, an average 37% of the population admits to having unfavorable views of Muslims. The mainstream Western media usually give coverage to Muslim matters through the prism of negative and counterproductive stereotypes. This biased coverage further promotes unreal stereotypes. In addition, European leaders have either been unsuccessful or reluctant in providing a convincing counter-narrative to Islamophobia. The UK has announced a controversial deal with Rwanda to send illegal immigrants and asylum seekers to the East African country. The British government claims this scheme, which is worth $156 million, would stop smugglers from sending thousands of desperate migrants on dangerous journeys across the English Channel every year. Over 28,000 migrants and refugees have crossed the English Channel in 2021. That's three times higher than the year before. In November last year, 27 people died while trying to reach the UK when their boat sank in the worst disaster to occur on the Channel. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson hailed the deal with Kigali, saying the East African country with a sketchy human rights record is one of the safest countries in the world, globally recognized for its record of welcoming and integrating migrants. Rwanda already hosts some 140,000 refugees in six refugee camps. However, rights groups and refugee organizations swiftly slammed what they called a cruel, inhumane, and neo-colonial plan. They also questioned both its costs to British taxpayers and its effect on migration. According to a recent poll, 60% of the British public is dissatisfied with the Johnson government's migration policy. The UN's refugee agency has also voiced opposition, saying people fleeing persecution should not be treated like commodities. The world body stated that such arrangements simply shift asylum responsibilities, evade international obligations, and are contrary to the letter and spirit of the Refugee Convention. Others have criticized Rwanda's human rights record, accusing the government of torturing, intimidating, and assassinating their political opponents and persecuting marginalized people. Johnson said the deal will become a new international standard in handling migration, but human rights groups have warned that the plan could set a dangerous trend for other Western countries to adopt their offshore asylum schemes.
Well, Britain has a good history of trading in human beings. As you know, the whole sort of movement of Africans to North America, Britain was a leading player in shipping slaves from Africa to North America and to Caribbean islands. So Britain has a track record of trading in human beings. So one could, if you like, describe it in that manner. But I think the evil aspect of what's really happening in 2022, that may have happened 200 years ago, and when later on slavery was banned. But the reality is that perhaps we are living in a new epoch of slavery at this time.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has vowed to curb the English Channel crossings. However, there has been a drastic increase in the number of people arriving on British shores on small boats in recent years. The government passed a Nationality and Borders Bill that would make it a criminal offence to enter the UK illegally, and it would introduce life sentences for people smugglers. But the UN's refugee agency criticised the bill, saying it would penalise most refugees seeking asylum in the country and would create an asylum model that undermines established international refugee protection rules and practices. Meanwhile, the refugee deal with Rwanda comes as more Ukrainians arrive in the UK through different visa programs that the Johnson government has rolled out in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine war. Over 55,000 visas have been issued to refugees fleeing the conflict in Ukraine so far. This clearly shows a contradiction between the proposed policy and the British government's attitude toward Ukrainian refugees.
The reality is that the British government is acting in a very racist manner as well. You know, they might say that, okay, it was sort of media correspondence who depicted the European the Ukrainian refugees in that manner. But the reality is that the implementation of this policy perhaps smacks of what I call racism, clear and without any sort of dilution to it.
Unlike what the British government claims, those seeking to cross the English Channel and land on British soil are not illegal economic migrants, but are mainly those who have escaped bloodshed, war and terror. They are people fleeing oppression and violence from Afghanistan, West Asia or even Europe. They are exercising their right under the UN Refugee Convention, which the UK was a founding signatory of, to seek asylum in a country of their choosing. And let's not forget that they are no different from Ukrainian refugees.
Israeli forces have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds and attacked the Palestinian worshippers there. The raid began at dawn on Friday when Israeli forces entered the compound through the Moroccan Gate, also known as the Mughrabi Gate, throwing stun grenades and shooting rubber bullets at the crowd indiscriminately. 400 Palestinians were arrested. Media reports said the Israeli forces also attacked paramedics and press crews, chased them in the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque, and beat a number of them. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society reported that 152 fasting Palestinians had been transferred to hospitals in the occupied Al-Quds for injuries as a result of the raid. Following the Friday prayers, people held rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with the Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
They want it for themselves. They want the Palestinians gone. They want Islam to be gone from Palestine and Christianity too, everything except Judaism. So really, they don't mind having this as a flashpoint for them, as a center of dispute. They want this dispute to go on until they win. That's what they're looking for. And every time they bring settlers there to cause trouble, it's part of what they see as a continuing war for their control of the land. That's what this is about.
The regime has stepped up its deadly acts of aggression across the Palestinian territories since the beginning of Ramadan, as a result of which, Palestinians put up a stronger resistance to counter the aggression. The events unfolding in the occupied territories are reminiscent of clashes between the Israeli forces and Palestinians in the West Bank last year that led to an 11-day war between the resistance groups in Gaza and Israel. Over 250 Palestinians were killed in the war, many of them were women and children. Observers now believe that more confrontations are imminent. As the pressure mounts, Palestinians have stepped up their retaliatory operations against Israelis. Over the past 3 weeks, Palestinians have carried out 4 such retaliatory operations, killing over a dozen Israelis. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has given the regime's forces a free hand to crack down on Palestinians. He has also called on Israeli civilians with gun licenses to carry weapons in public.
They can find ways to make the Israeli occupation painful. And already, actually, quite a few Israelis over the last decade have emigrated elsewhere. You have Israeli immigration into Europe and the United States and to Australia. Possibly as many as 1 million Israelis have done that. If the Palestinians can make it painful enough for the Israelis might just disappear.
When some Arab states announced the normalization of ties with Israel, they claimed that their moves will help the Palestinian cause. But the events of the past couple of years have shown that the only contribution their newly established ties with Tel Aviv made to Palestinians has been even more suffering. In the absence of any accountability, Israel is expected to put even more pressure on the people of Palestine. But the Palestinians are indicating that they remain steadfast to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation with or without international support.
Racial tensions are running high in Grand Rapids, Michigan, after police this week released footage of a white officer lying on the back of an unarmed black man, shooting him in the head. Patrick Leoya, 26, was killed on April 4th after a struggle during a traffic stop. State police are investigating the incident. The officer is currently on administrative leave pending the outcome of the investigation. Authorities say he would not be identified unless criminal charges are pressed against him. The family of Leoya called the video of the shooting, quote, the most horrifying thing they've ever seen, and asked for the officer's name to be released. The shooting has led to protests in the area, with activists expressing grief and frustration with years of inaction on policing issues by Grand Rapids leaders.
Given the U.S.'s long history of police brutality, from Rodney King to George Floyd and now today, we can't be shocked. And I think that the black community should and is justified in being angry at the establishment and seeking methods outside of the establishment and the political structure for seeking change.
The fatal shooting of the unarmed black man by the white officer is the latest on a very long list of similar incidents. Police killings of black men have dominated national debates in recent years, particularly after the 2020 murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which triggered persistent protests across America. The deep-rooted problem lingers on. So far this year, over 250 people have been fatally shot by on-duty police officers nationwide. The latest case is another bitter reminder that the system in the United States has failed to take measures to resolve the pressing problem. The April 4th shooting has once again brought deadly police violence in America under the spotlight. Civil rights organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, has been quick to react. The NAACP, which tries to advance justice for African Americans, said in a statement that the shooting is horrifying and deeply frustrating because Americans had meaningful legislation designed to avoid exactly what they are witnessing in this week's police video. It said the involved officer has blood on his hands, and so do the senators who killed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. The piece of legislation was passed by the U.S. House of Representatives in March 2021, but bipartisan negotiations in the U.S. Congress over the police reform bill ended in stalemate. The sweeping legislation was passed by the House amid outcry after the murder of George Floyd. It would have banned chokeholds and qualified immunity for law enforcement. It would have also created national standards for policing in an effort to increase accountability.
Lack of efforts to reform the system that are coming from the top. There's no real incentive for legislators to reform when they are benefiting off of the corrupt policing system and corrupt judicial system that this country has. There's also a lack of struggle in the organizations, a lack of structure in the organizations that are struggling against police brutality.
The failure to pass the police reform has been considered as a setback for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden, who had energetically supported the legislation. President Biden has faced growing calls to sign an executive order to reform the police, but has failed to act. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon. Observers have largely attributed this to the racist roots of American policing and social structures.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
So what benefit do the satanic elements in the West get by trying to desecrate the sanctity of the Holy Quran on the pretext of freedom of expression and action? Nothing except exposing their own devilish nature, which is unfortunately aided and abetted by certain European and other countries, despite their dubious claim to respect human rights. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading, Devilish Disrespect Does Not Diminish Dynamism of Holy Quran. Stay tuned for more. Those who submit themselves to the will of one and only creator of the entire universe on the basis of the fundamental principle of monotheism in its purest form and acknowledge Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as the Almighty's last messenger in the unbroken chain of God's representatives in every part of planet Earth, beginning with the father of the human race, Adam, are called Muslims. Consequently, Muslims who respect all the prophets that God had sent for guidance of various nations and revere the heavenly scriptures given to some of them, such as the Torah to Moses and the Evangel to Jesus, hold the Holy Quran as the final divine revelation for all humanity, since Islam is a universal creed. Thus, Muslims never disrespect the holy books of other religions, leave alone torching them, even when it is known that the various versions of these texts in circulation amongst their followers have not been preserved in the original form and were subjected to interpolation. Interestingly, the Holy Quran is hailed as the eternal miracle granted by the Lord Most High as proof of the universal mission of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, in view of the fact that it's challenge to skeptics to try to produce even a few lines matching its flawless eloquence and timeless wisdom remains unanswered to this day, as admitted by scholars in every age and place, including the Christian Arab literary. So what benefit do the satanic elements in the West get by trying to desecrate the sanctity of the Holy Quran on the pretext of freedom of expression and action? Nothing, except exposing their own devilish nature, which is unfortunately aided and abetted by certain European and other countries, despite their dubious claim to respect human rights. The Islamic Republic of Iran thus summoned the Swedish ambassador in Tehran to the foreign ministry on Sunday, April 18th, and lodged a strong protest for the latest act of sacrilege in Sweden towards the scripture revered by almost 2 billion Muslims all over the world, as well as hundreds of millions of other human beings. The statement said, "Iran strongly condemns the burning of a copy of the Holy Quran in the Swedish city of Linköping by a Danish racist extremist, which was done under the protection of the Swedish police on the pretext of freedom of speech, calling on Stockholm to take immediate, severe, and explicit action against the perpetrator, as well as practical measures to prevent such incidents in future," Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson Said Khatibzadeh said. "Blasphemy is an evident example of hatred in contrast with freedom of speech and should be condemned by all those who believe in coexistence and dialogue between faiths." The recent sacrilegious offense by leader of the Danish hardline party, Rasmus Paludan, that led to riots in several parts of Sweden and injury to innocent men, women and children, was not first instance of devilish disrespect towards the Holy Quran, and neither would be the last in view of the satanic intentions of the enemies of humanity. These frustrated forces of Lucifer, however, should know that they cannot avert the inevitable, and as many, including the Irish philosopher and playwright George Bernard Shaw, had predicted, Islam will be the future religion of Europe.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ramadan is the month of penitence. Among the characteristics that have been mentioned for the month of Ramadan, what particularly attracts my attention is the month of penitence. I'd like to discuss this point with you government officials. Penitence means going back when you realize that you are treading the wrong path, doing the wrong thing, and cherishing the wrong thought. It means turning back to Allah, the Exalted. This penitence has a meaning that is inherent to it. Going back means that we should find out where the problems lie and identify the path that is wrong. This is a very important point. As we move along, we often tend to turn a blind eye to the mistakes we make and to our faults. We fail to notice the problems that plague our work. That this happens in our individual responsibilities as well as our collective responsibilities involving our nation, our party, our movement, or our camp. We often ignore the problems with everything that is related to us. Therefore, other people should point out our flaws.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
It appears that the month of Ramadan, among other months of the year, is like prayer time among other times of the day. That is to say, Holy Sharia has provided opportunities in the form of prayers for people who are restricted by material factors. The five daily prayer times are like an alarm. They provide us with a kind of privacy in order to illuminate our hearts and souls. Daily prayers have been made obligatory in order to prevent us from being submerged in the material world. They provide us with the opportunity to step out the material world, think about spirituality, and be submerged in the material world. It appears that the month of Ramadan has the same characteristic among other months of the year. It provides the human soul with an opportunity to break free. The month of Ramadan is an opportunity for our souls to be purified of material factors that surround us. It provides an opportunity for our souls to become illuminated. One of the great achievements of the month of Ramadan is repentance and returning to Allah the Exalted. In the holy du'a of Abu Hamza Thumali, we read, "Let us gather around Mustafa and achieve the position of returning to you. We ask God to help us to achieve the position of repentance so that we can return to him and return from deviant, bad, indecent actions, thoughts, and conducts." In the farewell dua of the auspicious month of Ramadan, Imam Sajjal alayhi salam says to the God of the world, "You are one who opened a door for your servants so that they return to you. So that they can return to you, and you name this door repentance." Sahifat al-Sajjadiyya, dua number 45. He says to God that he opened this door for us so that we rush towards his forgiveness and benefit from the blessing of his forgiveness and mercy. This door is the door of repentance. It is a window to the pure view of divine forgiveness.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
we are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Russian military operation in Ukraine has captured the attention of the world, and the Western powers are arming, funding, and providing political and humanitarian support for the Ukrainians. Meanwhile, Palestine has slipped off the global agenda, and besieged, blockaded, and bombed Gaza has become invisible. Dear listeners, we now present you an article in this regard written by Michael Jensen, a political commentator. The piece is titled, "The Zionist Regime Setting Gazans Adrift from National Identity and Nullifying Their Claim to Palestine." Please stay tuned. On February 23rd, the day before the Russian operation in Ukraine, Al-Haq, the Palestinian human rights organization, released a report entitled "Cultural Apartheid: Israel's Erasure of Palestinian Heritage in Gaza." The report is based on an investigation by Forensic Architecture, a research organization based in London, which managed to virtually reconstruct key ancient sites in the Israeli-occupied and bombarded Gaza Strip. Al-Haq and Forensic Architecture accused the Zionist regime of using strategic strikes to erase Gaza's rich cultural heritage, thereby denying Palestinians, as Al-Haq put it, the right to self-determination over their cultural resources, and by extension, threatens their existence as a people. Around 12,000 archaeological sites have been surveyed in the Palestinian territories since 1967 Israeli regime occupation. Three West Bank Palestinian sites have been chosen for UNESCO's World Heritage List: the Church of Nativity in Beit Lahm, the Old City of Al-Khalil, and the cultural landscape of northern Al-Quds around the village of Batir. UNESCO dubbed the latter Palestine Land of Olives and Vines, as the hills around Batir is terraced for olive orchards and vegetable gardens, which are watered by traditional underground networks. Since the Old City in Al-Quds and its walls are disrupted, UNESCO has not assigned them to either Palestine or the regime of Israel. The State of Palestine has submitted three sites in Gaza to UNESCO for consideration. Situated near Al-Shati refugee camp, Antidon Harbor is the oldest known port on Gaza Mediterranean coast. Antidon Harbor, which was seriously damaged during the Zionist regime's 2021 bombing of Gaza, was inhabited between 800 BC to 1100 AD and served as a major trading hub on the commercial route between Europe and the Levant. The ancient Roman settlement of Tel Omer, the birthplace of Saint Hilarion near Al-Nusayrat village on Gaza coast, the settlement was located on the road connecting Mesopotamia to Egypt. One of the most important coastal wetlands on the eastern Mediterranean is Wadi Gaza, which stretches 105 kilometers from the Negev Hills and the southern Al-Khalil Heights to the east Gaza and follows a circuitous route for 7 kilometers through Gaza. The wetlands are not only rich in diversity of flora and fauna, but also a staging area for migratory birds. These sites delve deep into Gaza's history as a land bridge between Egypt and Mesopotamia, Iraq, and the Levant, and on the continental scale between Africa and West Asia. Gaza was a crossroads of multiple civilizations, Egyptian, Greek, Mesopotamian, Persian, and Arab, to name the key empires which impacted on this narrow coastal strip until the Zionist regime occupied the lands, imprisoned Palestinians, and halted traffic along the Palestinian coast. During its 1948-49 war, the regime of Israel drove the inhabitants from cities, towns, and villages into Gaza, where refugees now count for 70% of the strip's 2.1 million people. The destructive impact of this influx and long-term presence on Gaza's rich cultural heritage cannot be calculated. Contractors building housing, infrastructure, and manufacturing plants have both destroyed heritage sites and made extensive collections of ancient Greek pottery, coins, and Islamic relics, while fishermen and swimmers continue to discover and sell antiquities washed onto beaches or dredged up from the sea. In 2008, builder Jawad Qadri opened a one-room museum called Al Madaf to display some of his treasures. Located off the coast near the Shati refugee camp, Al Madaf welcomes busloads of school children who have little knowledge of the long history of their beleaguered and impoverished. In January 2009, Al-Madaf was struck by shrapnel and pottery smashed when the Israeli regime bombed a nearby sports field during its 2008-2009 attack on Gaza. A second museum has been opened at Al-Gharara, an ancient site south of Gaza City by Muhammad and Najla Abu Lahia. The collection features artifacts from 4000 BC through the Roman, Byzantine, early Islamic, and Ottoman empires, and includes wooden plows, horse saddles, baskets, and items used half a century ago. During Israeli regime's 2014 offensive, Al-Haq reported the destruction of 61 and damage to 120 mosques and partial damage to a church. During the May 2021, the Israeli regime assault, both ancient and modern and heritage sites were targeted or indirectly damaged due to bombing of nearby areas as well as 124 places of worship. Among the sites struck were the Great Omari Mosque, the second oldest in Palestine, the Kitab al-Walaya Mosque, the historic Church of St. Porphyrius, and Tal Amr, and the ruins of St. Hilarion Monastery. Al-Haq has called on the International Criminal Court to initiate prosecutions of the Zionist regime for targeting cultural property as this fundamentally affects the core of Palestinians' identity and their existence as people and constitutes a crime against humanity. Furthermore, destruction of cultural heritage, which takes place under an illegal apartheid regime, is also a crime against humanity. By destroying Palestinian connections to their land, the civilizations which have ruled Gaza and its distinctive culture, the regime of Israel seeks to set Gazans adrift from their national identity and nullify their claim to Palestine. This is what Daesh tried to do so by devastating the heritage of Syria and Iraq with the aim of destroying the millennial identities of Syrians and Iraqis so they would submit to the outfit harsh, uncivilized regime.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Dozens of people gathered in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, to mark Palestinian Prisoners' Day, a day when resistance factions and their supporters stand in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails.
On this day, which marks the Day of Palestinian Prisoners, I am certain that the people of the Arab and Muslim worlds, as we see in this gathering, will show the true unity with the resistance and the path of the resistance, especially with the issue of the prisoners and Al-Quds, which are the emblem of the Palestinian struggle.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that one cannot be truly with Palestine if they are not with the resistance.
It has become clear that whoever is with Palestine should be with the resistance. Anyone who has declared that he is with Palestine but hasn't taken one practical step in supporting the resistance is not truly with Palestine. Military resistance comes first. The other forms of resistance back and help to serve the actual resistance with arms.
He recalled that after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, late Imam Khomeini took the decision to close the Israeli embassy and reinstate the Palestinian embassy before declaring he was with Palestine. Liberating Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails has become a struggle for all resistance factions as it is linked directly to the Palestinian cause. They stress that liberating prisoners can only be realized completely by liberating Palestine. Officials of Palestinian resistance groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad considered that history has proven that only armed struggle can be a path to liberating both Al-Quds and the prisoners who continue to suffer from Israel's aggressive policies. More than 4,400 Palestinian prisoners are currently held in Israeli jails. Minors and women are among 500 detainees under the so-called administrative detention policy, under which they are held without charge or trial for an indefinite time period. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Italians have slammed Israel's continued pursuit of repressive, violent practices against Palestinians following the killing of several Muslims, including a teenage boy, by Israeli security forces at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, a major holy site in Al-Quds, last week. Tensions between Israelis and Palestinians have been running high over the past weeks, with Israeli forces carrying out numerous raids in the West Bank, which led to the deaths of a number of Palestinians. The latest round of violence by Israel on Monday saw its soldiers forcing their way into the Al-Aqsa Mosque and removing worshippers from its courtyards in order to allow settlers to exclusively mark the Passover holiday into the compound.
Once again, during Ramadan, a new aggression against Palestinians by the Israeli regime. This time they caught off guard men, women and children who were praying at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This again has shown the nature of the Israeli regime and the complacence of the international community.
Last year, during Ramadan, similar violence broke out, sparking the biggest conflict in years between Palestinian resistance movements and Israel, an 11-day war which only ended following intervention by international mediators. The violence against Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds came at a particularly sensitive time. Ramadan this year coincided with the Christian Holy Week, which ends today, Monday, the second day of Eastertide. Catholic faithful have strongly condemned the latest killing of Palestinians by Israeli security forces.
For the umpteenth time, it is a provocation by Israel. This action were just a fresh provocation. There is a lack of respect for others' beliefs. During Easter time and Ramadan, we have to be more thoughtful.
Tensions there are due exclusively to Israeli occupation policy. However, the international community seems to have lost interest in the conflict. By not taking any side, the Italian government is supporting Israel in practical terms.
Last meeting between Italian and Palestinian authorities took place in December when Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki met his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio on the sidelines of the 7th edition of the Rome-Med Dialogues Conference. Other than reiterating Italy's traditional support for the Palestinian Authority, Di Maio reaffirmed Italy's commitment to a just, sustainable and negotiated two-state